Thank you for having me here. Very excited to have you. So two things. First thing is, after receiving this slightly terrifying email inviting me here, I decided to take seriously the short talk format. So I'm going to try to hit about half an hour, 35 minutes. That's the goal. The second thing is, this is going to be a slightly weird mixture of material. There's going to be a little bit of advertising of previous work, because what's going on in this paper is I'm revisiting something I've argued before and I've gotten worried about, and trying to explain why my earlier point wasn't entirely wrong, though it could have been put better, and why the cool epistemic thing I want to say is still relevant and cool and important. That's the claim anyways. So the goal of the paper is to investigate the entanglement of logical, but also evaluative material in our best abductive methodology and its epistemological consequences. And just a little bit of historical exegesis. This is something that's been bugging me for a really, really, really long time. When I was a grad student, I read Gil Harman's Change of View, which I thought was a great book. But after a while, the repeated claims that logic was in no way special to reasoning drove me crazy, because it occurred to me that if you really wanted to get clear on abductive methodology and things like theoretical virtues, they embed an entailment relation, which is a chunk of logic. So in some sense, logic is really special, because it's part of what explains how we decide things like simplicity, strength, and so on. So this is my latest outing on this sort of hobby horse of mine. So let me start off by introducing two types of arguments that I'm going to be concerned with. The first one may be familiar, though not in this particular form. It's a type of debunking argument. And debunking arguments occur throughout the literature, especially in metaethics, especially recently with some work from Sharon Street and Richard Joyce, and then people have gone past this. And debunking arguments are an attempt to show that given a particular type of explanation of why we believe the things we do about stuff, we should get worried about whether they're actually really tracking stuff in reality. There's a lot of fights in the literature about how to best portray debunking arguments. I don't really have I was actually just about to say I don't have a dog in that fight, but I'm against dog fighting. I don't have a horse in that race. I'm going to move on to what I think the best type of debunking argument is. Again, due to Gil Harman, at least originally. And it goes like this. You've got what you might think of as an independence claim about the content of your beliefs. So our beliefs about some domain D are realistic in the sense of describing mind-independent worldly structures. So maybe morality is like that, if you're David Enoch, right? Maybe mathematics is like that, if you're what's sometimes called a robust Platonist. It's a little difficult to cash out mind-independent worldly structure in a way that's helpful and non-trivial and not open to counterexample. What I kind of mean is not causally related to the mid-sized dry goods and not grounded in them either. That's what I mean by that. We can find about it in the Q&A if you want. And then we have a genealogical premise. So the best explanation of us having, say, the moral or mathematical belief we do have does not involve their truth. I.e., there isn't a feedback loop from the fact the content of this thing being true to why we believe it. So when Harman puts this out, he contrasts, for example, the case of moral belief with the case of perceptual belief. He says, look, the best explanation, for example, why I think there's a chair there involves the fact that there is a chair there. And various, basically there are bits bopping off of the thing and feeding into my eyeballs and somehow coming to for me to represent the chair. The best explanation of that is there's a chair. So the truth of there's a chair plays a role, not the fact that it's true. But the fact what it describes plays a role in why I believe it. But by hypothesis, that's not true of the moral case, because it's causally isolated from us, right? And then we have what I call IBE minus. So a negative version of inference to the best explanation says that the truth and content of our realistic, say moral or mathematical beliefs, is not involved in the best explanation of our possessing them, then we need additional reasons to believe them. Conclusion, we epistemically ought not to continue believing our moral or mathematical beliefs unless we have additional epistemically relevant reasons to believe them.
Right? So the idea is, look at the fact that we believe it. Note that our best ways of using abductive justification doesn't work in this case, not like the perceptual case. And that puts pressure, epistemic pressure, on continuing to believe it. That's not to say that epistemic pressure can't be met. That's not to say there aren't additional reasons you can muster in service of them, but you need to do a little bit more. Okay, so that's the first argument schema. I'm just going to refer to this as the debunking argument. I mean this thing, something with this schema. Here's another argument that I've recently become very interested in. I've been interested in it in the case of logic, so I'll spell it out that way, though it's more general. So theory A of such and so, so a particular logical theory is better than another logical theory along various metrics, M1 through MN. Then OTC says we ought to believe whichever theory of such and so, that is logic in this case, which does best along the relevant metrics. Therefore, we ought to come to believe A, if it does better, absent sufficient epistemically relevant reasons to refrain. So the idea there is, take something like a logical theory. This is recent, very popular methodology of the philosophy of logic. Look at various metrics, how simple, how elegant, how strong, how intuitive. Somehow come to assign a value to these. Somehow get from that to a weighing function. Look at whichever one does better across the weighing function, and that's the logical theory you should come to believe. Okay? So, both of these arguments are fairly pervasive throughout the literature. They're really important and really interesting. First thing I want to point out, both IBE minus and OTC involve pretty directly an abductive or inference to the best explanation style principle, right? These are not deductive arguments. These are something like IBE-style arguments. Now that means first and foremost, and you'll see this as explicitly highlighted in the conclusion in the italicized phrase at the end, that the best you get out of them is a defeasible conclusion about what you ought to do. Right? Standard, you know, IBE in, defeasible conclusion out. Now, here's something else to notice. Look at IBE. We need the notion of a best explanation. What's the best explanation? Presumably, it's the simplest, strongest, most natural, most elegant explanation of some phenomenon. Right? Now, we can fight about the particular virtues that go in. Usually, you want something like adequacy to the data plus a list of other nice features of a theory. I think that actually the best explanation of some phenomenon needs to also be a reasonably likely explanation of some phenomenon. Fight about that. And if you look at OTC, the second argument, we've got another thing. We've got metrics. So simplicity, strength, naturalness, and elegance. Again, adequacy to the data, stuff like that. Getting fed. Now, this just goes back to how I introduced this. Each of those criteria, except perhaps elegance, a little tricky in the elegance case, requires cashing out, and that cashing out requires additional theoretical virtues. You want to know how simple a theory is. You need to talk about a simplicity measure. In order to define a simplicity measure, you need a non-trivial, not huge, but non-trivial amount of logic. You want to talk about how strong a theory is. And usually that involves weighing out the various entailments, right? Or predictions that are made there. And you can look, if you look at the history of this stuff, I mean, Thagard is like the Thagard? Anyways, Thagard is a classic example of this, who goes on and actually gives explicit definitions of these virtues, and of course they're done in terms of a background consequence relation. That's the natural way to do it. Now that means that when the conclusion of an argument suggests modifying or changing our basic logical beliefs, for instance, then we can undermine our justification for the conclusion by following its demand. For example, imagine we ran something like ordinary theory choice, the OTC argument, the second argument I gave, about comparing logical theories. What happens when the conclusion is change your logic to something weaker? Well, what happens is you're no longer immediately justified in your claims about what the most simple or strong or elegant theory was, because it was relied upon a different consequence relation than the one you should be using. So presumably, you have to go back and redo the comparison, make sure that it's still right. And there is no guarantee that the resulting sort of comparison will come out the same way. Because if you change the background consequence relation, you can change how simple, strong, or elegant a theory is perceived to be. In the debunking case, you can do a similar thing. It can be the case that the best explanation of some phenomenon looks really good until you drop a certain set of background beliefs which were involved in justifying that it was the best explanation of some phenomenon. So it can be the case that following up the debunking argument, you end up having to say that you are no longer justified in one of the premises that got you to the skeptical conclusion. And that looks pretty bad. I'll call cases like this slightly inaptly cases of self-effacement. It can be problematic. It's not obvious. It's not always problematic, but it looks bad on its face. And it puts pressure, I think, on our ability to use these sort of arguments to settle, unsettle orthodoxy about this or that subject. I said this is going to be looking at some earlier stuff. So I've actually explored in print two of these arguments, both of these arguments in different ways. So in the debunking argument case, I've argued explicitly that if you look at the constraints of judging mathematical theories, and you look at the involvement of logic and mathematics in justifying that something's the best explanation, there is a non-trivial fragment of either logic or mathematics, depending on how you cash it out, which is in some sense protected. Because if you were to come to doubt it on the basis of the debunking argument, you would lose your justification in the fact that the best explanation of your moral or mathematical beliefs, or at least your mathematical beliefs, was something like the genealogical explanation. That is, you would no longer be able to justify that premise. I contrasted that in that work with the idea that you could do something similar for morality, and what I pointed out is on the ordinary cashings out of theoretical virtues, you don't need morality to justify our best explanation of moral symbols. So I use that to argue that there was a striking contrast between maths and morals, contra people like Justin Cardone, which is that when you look at abductive justifications of maths and morals, in the math case, those methodologies explicitly part of what you're considering, which means you can sort of block some of these skeptical arguments. In the morals case, because you can run those arguments clean, there's no block. But that was the thought. In other work, some forthcoming work, I've pointed out that if you pick, actually I'm just going to write this down. If you pick the right set of logics, let's call them with absolutely no reference to people at all, C and T. You can show that by C's lights, T is preferable to C. And you can show that by T's lights, is that right? Actually, I wrote this wrong. What I mean here is T is better than C. So you can show that by C's lights, T is better than C, and by T's lights, C is better than T. Sorry. Why am I doing it that abstractly? Classical logic will prove that a particular logic T is better than classical logic. And that other logic, if you start evaluating by its lights, it will say that classical logic is better than itself. Which means if you wanted to apply this methodology and you didn't have some very fancy way out, you would get yourself into a decision cycle. Right? Anytime you were called upon to evaluate in such a way, you end up switching back and forth across these two logics. That looks really bad. Okay. I'm not going to go into super detail about this here. If we want to talk about the Q&A, it's a really interesting case, and it's actually fairly pervasive. Now, what I argued in both cases was that these problems legitimated a little bit of what I call immodesty, right? About our set of logical and mathematical beliefs. That is, I argue that we are sort of entitled to hold on to them, even in light of the epistemic case against them. Since those cases presume for their justification exactly what's under consideration. And immodesty is meant to be sort of a blanket way of describing this sort of phenomenon where you're entitled to sort of ignore an epistemic case against some of your beliefs because that case itself rests on those beliefs being true.
Okay.
This particular played out in two ways. So in the debunking case, I just argued sort of straightforwardly that the skeptical conclusion didn't follow, given the fact that it rested on these things being true. In the case of logic, I argued for a principle that I call logical partisans. Again, with no no political intent, which claim that when you compare two logics, unless, say, T and C agree that one is better, stay where you are. That is, when you're comparing two logics, in order to get a reason to shift out of that comparison from one logic to another, it had better be the case that you can construct cases for moving to the preferred logic from both sides of the equation. Right? Okay, so that's the historical advertising part. Really cool problems, fairly pervasive, interesting epistemic structure. Here's the problem. Here's the problem I'm now confronting. That was meant to be a limited defense. So I was trying to do this thing where I argued that logic and mathematics were fine, rock solid, secure, and like these skeptical arguments, even though you could run them, they weren't going to really imperil logic and mathematics, or at least a reasonably small fragment of. I did not want that to stretch out to showing that any old domain was going to be protected from skeptical doubt in this kind of way. Here's the trouble. It's a non-trivial, and I'm not even sure it's true these days, though I'm worried about it, presumption that in evaluating things like the best explanation of some phenomenon, you are using purely theoretical in the intuitive sense materials. That's not obvious. It's not obvious to me. I'm presuming for this point, and again, this can come up in Q&A, a division between theoretical and evaluative content, or really a distinction between fact and value. I don't want to defend that. I think you could run versions of what I'll say during the rest of the talk, even if you didn't presume it, it would be harder. So I'm going to work with that going forward. But I do recognize that there's another non-trivial presumption here. Okay. So was it a reasonable assumption? Was it reasonable for me to assume, as I did, that the best explanation of something like what a best explanation is, the best sort of cashing out of that, or when you compare two logics, the things you wanted to bring to bear were theoretical virtues, not evaluative virtues. Here's an immediate reason you might be suspicious of that. Go back to the list I started off with. Simplest, strongest, most natural, elegant. Okay, simple and strong seem okay. Those seem theoretical. Most natural? I don't mean natural in the metaphysical sense of picking out properties with party caps on them. I mean natural in a sort of intuitive psychological sense, the kind of thing you'd expect to be true. Is that a theoretical virtue? Not clearly. And elegance? Elegance is an aesthetic virtue. And as far as I can tell, there's no way of cashing out a notion of mathematical elegance or logical elegance or theoretical elegance that isn't itself simply aesthetic in a certain way. That looks evaluative. That doesn't look like a factual claim. That looks evaluative. So immediate problem, immediate worry for this sort of stuff. Here's a more contentious example that I'm really interested in. In some recent draft work and some published work by someone else, Jeff Sayer McCord has been arguing that there's a defensible sense in which a morally better theory is a better moral theory. And what he means is that the fact that a moral theory is immoral is itself a reason to think, an epistemic reason to think you've got it wrong. Right? Actually, this, if you dig through the meta switch, you find versions of this floating around, right? For example, it's often taken to be a really bad making feature of certain
say, consequentialist type views, that you're not in a position to actually believe it and satisfy it at the same time. That's not the same kind of thing, but pretty close, and you can work it into the relevant sort of example. So Jeff's thought, I think it's a good thought, interesting thought anyways, is that part of what goes into the evaluation of what the best kind of moral theory is the morality of that theory. Not just in a, like, should we believe it in a pragmatic sense, but in a theoretical sense. Now, I'm not interested in defending his thesis here, but I think it's not a crazy hypothesis. And if you weaken it even a little bit, all you get the claim that how moral a particular theory is plays a role in determining whether we ought to believe it. And if you want it to fit the debunking style of argument, right, just change that to the best explanation of why we believe a particular moral theory ought to vindicate that it's good that we believe that theory. Or it's good that we believe our theory is good, or something like that. Feed that back in to the earlier point I made, and it looks like the fact that something's the best explanation of the fact that we believe such and so about morality might itself involve moral content. And insofar as it involves moral content, if you come to doubt the systematic truth of your moral beliefs, right, on the basis of a skeptical conclusion like that, you could lose something which would play this tie-breaking role in the fact that something's the best explanation of our moral beliefs, thereby undermining your justification for the skeptical conclusion. So why isn't it, or is it, that moral facts, just like what I call facts about logic and mathematics, why are they not insulated? It looks like they are, in some sense, insulated from doubt in the way that I argue mathematics and logic is. And similarly with things like, in what I call contentious example two, aesthetic or evaluative concepts like things like elegance. Why isn't elegance protected, right? In the way that something like our basic logical and mathematical beliefs are protected, right? Because it does look, again, like if you have a comparison, the tiebreaker theoretical virtue is elegance between the two of them. If you come to doubt, and it's about the content you're evaluating, it's about elegance. And if it turns out that systematically coming to doubt your beliefs about elegance would drop your ability to carry out that justification that it was the best explanation of our, say, aesthetical beliefs. So you got the same sort of recipe there that you had in the mathematics and logic case. Okay. So this is why I got troubled. I got troubled because it looked like I had this argument which I liked to protect logic and mathematics against skeptical doubt, in particular to vindicate, for example, being a classical logician or an intuitionistic logician against all the waves of non-classical logics floating around the literature, and a way to push off certain skeptical doubts about mathematics that would happen if you were a Platonist about mathematics. And what I've come to worry about recently is that this will just spread through all kinds of cases where I think it's not intuitive that we can block skeptical doubt in this way. Right? Doesn't strike me as intuitive that our beliefs about elegance or our beliefs about morality should be protected in the way that our beliefs about logic and mathematics are. So in the remainder of the talk, what I'm going to try to do is sketch out a way in which you might still maintain there's a pretty significant distinction. Okay. Tim, how am I doing on time?
Done about 20 minutes.
Perfect.
Just over.
Both. Okay. So if you look back at the arguments above, we should distinguish two types of cases. So the first case is a case where an argument is self-effacing. That is, we're coming to believe the conclusion on the basis of the premises would undermine your justification of the premises. Right? So go back to the debunking case. It would be a case where coming to systematically doubt the truth of morality on the basis of the skeptical argument would undermine your justification that something was the best explanation of our mathematical beliefs. What should we draw from that fact? Well, one thing to note here is that even if it's true that those arguments won't work because they're self-effacing, you're not entitled to the conclusion because they're self-effacing, that doesn't show that the existence of those arguments isn't problematic for other reasons, right? So even if you thought, right, that These arguments by themselves didn't work to provoke, to throw doubt on our, say, more mathematical beliefs. Still, the argument doesn't go away when you realize that. That is, the epistemic case against our mathematical beliefs doesn't disappear, even if you can't follow through to its conclusion. And that's worrying, right? That's worrying. It's a nasty feature of a view if there are good epistemic reasons for within that view not holding it, even if you couldn't actually come to accept that conclusion on that basis, right? Something rotten down there, it seems like. And on the face of it, nothing, I haven't given an argument like this now, but nothing stops us from using the existence of these arguments in order to construct some independent argument against a particular domain, right? Why couldn't we use the fact that there are self-effacing arguments as a premise in some other skeptical argument? I mean, the upshot here is, in a certain sense, and this is a reaction when I was first reading the stuff I got from people when I talked about it, they were onto something. These kind of defenses against skepticism are cheap, right? They're cheap. They feel like there's still some deep underlying problem here. Actually, you get something similar if you look back at certain defenses of skepticism, kind of famous from the modern period, and then they recently resurfaced in the work of Susanna Renard. She's got these really great papers on self-undermining skeptical arguments, right? I think the paper's called Reasoning Your Way Out of Skepticism. And they're really lovely arguments, but something about them is a little funny because they feel like, again, a little bit like the defense is cheap. I'm sympathetic, I think it's right. Something, there's still something to say there. Now, notice one other thing that's really important. When we have self-effacement, the condition that I italicized in the arguments, i.e. the absence of additional reasons to continue believing, is met. Sorry, that there aren't additional reasons, that's met. Otherwise, you wouldn't actually have self-effacement. Because the conclusion is, you ought to come to disbelieve so long as there aren't sufficient additional reasons to maintain your belief. But of course, if there are sufficient additional reasons to maintain your belief, you're never actually going to get to detach the ought there, right? So if you really do have self-effacement, it's got to be the case that there aren't sufficient additional reasons to maintain your beliefs. Okay. That's the first type of argument. Here's the second type of argument. Where an argument like this wouldn't be self-effacing, but where the condition on the conclusion that we don't have additional reasons to maintain or refrain from believing them isn't met. That is, a case where the argument is not self-effacing, but it's only because that additional reasons claim is met, right? So I think it's here that we're gonna find the real distinction between mathematics and morality. And here's why. Even if the best explanation of morality requires using moral facts to justify the particular best explanation of that, that doesn't seem to me to be widespread. In this sense, it's one thing to think morality plays a role in the best explanation of morality. It's quite another thing to take morality to play the best role in the explanation of something like our beliefs about analysis, right? You can sort of see the case for why morality might be involved for justifying our moral beliefs. But why would morality be justified in the justification of our theoretical beliefs about, say, chairs, or mathematics, or logic? Well, why would that be true? In some sense, which virtues are relevant seems like it's kind of the main specific, right? Which means, well, let me go on a bit. Now, in the case of logic and mathematics, that's not true, right? Because simplicity and strength and adequacy to the data that is generating predictions and confirming them seems to be involved in any use of abductive methodology whatsoever. That seems to suggest that those features are not going to be domain specific, that it's just going to be broad spectrum, the use of logic and mathematics in these types of justifications. How much mathematics? Not very much, right? If you want to generate predictions, confirm them, you need roughly theory of syntax, theory of inductive definitions, minimal bit of logic itself, right? Ordinary propositional logic. If you want to spell out a notion of likelihood under which you can make claims like this theory is reasonably likely, you need a tiny fragment of mathematics, not very much, right? Maybe not analysis, but you know.
Chunk of arithmetic, depends on if you like ordinal analysis. If you want to do cardinal comparisons between how many objects a theory predicts, you're going to need a fragment of second order logic, because the quantifier, there are more A's than B's, not first orderizable. Right, so you need a bit, a ton, no. Everything we're talking about here is like at the absolute sort of minimum level, but it's not nothing. And it looks like it's involved everywhere. That doesn't seem to be true of the moral case, right? That means, in some sense, we've got a much stronger reason to hold on to our mathematical and logical beliefs and our moral beliefs, even in the face of skeptical arguments, because if you relinquish your moral and logical beliefs, you would lose wholesale your ability to carry out abductive justifications whatsoever, at least the way that we usually do. Whereas, even if it turned out that by jettisoning the moral case, you would make use of abductive methodology and morality troublesome, it wouldn't affect, it seems, our ability to carry out abductive justifications of things, investigations of things like tables and chairs and logic and mathematics itself. That means, I think, that you have a stronger reason. And that means, I think, that it's very plausible that that additional reasons clause is always met in the case of logic and mathematics. There always seems to be strong additional reason to hold on to our mathematical and logical beliefs, even in the face of doubt. And that doesn't seem a stronger case than mathematics. Sorry, morality. I'm going to scream if I mix up morality, mathematics, and logic one more time. So that's the idea. The idea is the depth of entanglement of logic and mathematics in our abductive methodology is simply stronger. There's just, it's more, it's everywhere, and that itself means that giving it up would mean giving up the use of inference to the best explanation and theory comparison quite generally. And that looks like it would be crippling on our ability to investigate the world around us, and in particular our beliefs about the world around us. And that doesn't seem true of morality. It seems much more site-specific. Okay? So I still think that there's a pretty significant difference here between the two cases. Even if it turns out that morality is necessary in order to give the best explanation of our moral beliefs. And actually, notice that that's a very contentious hypothesis. I said I'm sympathetic to it, and I am sympathetic to it. But it's not trivial to think that morality plays a role in our best explanation of our moral beliefs. In fact, one of the things that people who purport and give debunking arguments like Sharon Street and Richard Joyce and realists like people like David Enoch are fighting about is what additional reasons there are to maintain our beliefs in the face of these types of doubt. That's exactly what they're fighting about in many cases, right? So it's very contentious to think morality is playing a role in the Roman sense. But I don't think it's very contentious, and so I've tried to argue today that mathematics and logic are playing a relevant role. They seem deeply, deeply entangled. So there's my suggestion. It's a little less cut and dry than I would have liked. It's a little less damning than I would have liked against the moral case. But I still think it's a non-trivial distinction between the two of them. So I want to close on one very contentious example that I don't know what to do with, and invite people here to say something about it if they have an idea. Aesthetical considerations seem to be closer to logical and mathematical and how widespread they are. Elegance seems to play a role in most cases in which we sort of give a justification of something with being the best explanation of some theory, some facts, or our beliefs about them. That means the sort of justification I just gave for thinking that morality, the reasons to sort of hold on to morality in the face of skeptical arguments, doesn't really spread to the aesthetic case. The aesthetic case looks like it might be thoroughly protected in the way that the logical and mathematical are. So I don't know, is that a interesting consequence or a terrible problem with the argument? I haven't decided yet. But anyways, thank you very much for listening, and I'm looking forward to your questions.